Martial law declared in South Korea for 6 hours. A prominent healthcare CEO is killed in open street at daylight in the United States. The French government collapses on us, which is not really a surprise. And there's many more topics. Hello, Walter. Last week when we recorded, or actually this week when we recorded, so 5 days ago, I told you that I'm looking forward to a week without a quarterly political foreign policy crisis happening to us, so that we can maybe focus on one topic for once in an episode and we don't have to focus on five or six of them. How are you doing after this tumultuous week?
Hi, Dario. Yeah, I don't think that we will get any of those weeks in the foreseeable future. It seems as if every week, every month brings a new set of slightly surprising, but also consistent events that are moving the world into towards chaos, right? We are seeing a world which has so many signs, small signs, the ones that you mentioned, the ones that we discussed last week, and some bigger signs that show us that we are heading towards very uncertain times. Basically, control in society, certainly in Western society, is gone. We are no longer in a world where the future looks stable, where we can predict what our governance system will look like. And the issues that you just mentioned, as well as the issues from last week and from previous months, all head in that direction, right? It is not one CEO that is being murdered. It is a CEO representative of a system that is no longer working. It is not one attempt by a leader to declare martial law. It is a leader within a world where there is an increasing tendency by political elites to cling on to power. This is all part of a dynamic that should concern us all, and that is slightly depressing, to be honest.
It is slightly depressing because, I mean, this week was very comical in that sense because we recorded on Monday. And I remember saying in the episode, dear listeners, this episode only comes out on Wednesday. If something else happens in the next 2 days, please be aware that we will not be able to talk about it. And then less than 24 hours later, South Korean President Yoon declared martial law in South Korea for only 6 hours, luckily. But that really surprised me, that little prediction of, you know, something crazy is probably going to happen, that came true so quickly.
Yeah, and it is not just a single event. That is what makes it interesting, right? And also scary. So here is a country that since 1980 has been a democracy. You would think that it is enough time to establish stability. And if you believe that democracy is the end product of humanity, then there's nothing to worry about. But what we're seeing is that in the world, not just in South Korea, but broadly speaking in the Western world, there is this democratic backsliding and there's this tendency towards greater authoritarianism by governments. Trump is a very obvious example. You've got the Orbans in Europe. But also, for example, the way that COVID was handled, the way that terrorism was handled. The fact that in South Korea there is a attempt to declare martial law, which is essentially the first step to the end of democracy, is not an insular event. It's not an event that can be seen separate from these other dynamics. And I honestly wouldn't be surprised if in the next 20, 30 years we will see this happen in European countries as well.
Well, what a scary prediction. Or scenario.
One of the differences here, of course, is that what I would expect is that it's done a little bit more competently, right? The South Korea case was a exercise in political incompetence. I don't know enough about South Korea to understand really why this choice was made by Yoon, but it is very clear that if you want to declare more martial law, you have to have a good excuse to do that. And typically that excuse is either something like terrorism or like a virus, COVID, or something where you can say, in order to protect the people, I'm declaring martial law. This is not for me, but this is for you. That is the first step towards a society that is no longer free and democratic. In the case of South Korea, it was just done on a weird basis of claims about the opposition being controlled by North Korea, and obviously within a context of him being investigated for corruption and an opposition that has the majority in parliament, those kind of things. So it was way too self-serving. I would expect, if this were to happen in a European country in the next generation or so, that it wouldn't look self-serving, but it would look like a leader being decisively protective of his or her population.
Right. This goes back to the text exchange we had over exactly this topic, right? When I basically said, honestly, if you ask me, what is the reaction from Europe going to be, is that people will be taking notes. Okay, how do we do this or how do we not do this? But let's actually talk about, what happened exactly, right? So, listeners know this, that I have lived in South Korea for a year and a half, almost 2 years, and my stepmother is South Korean, right? So I feel a very close connection to the country, which is why for me, Tuesday evening, this was even scarier, right? Because you hear this once in a while about other countries. Oh, something is happening here. But at first, right, there was a personal connection to it. And second, South Korea, the way we sometimes talk about the Western bubble and the West, is part of the West, right? It's a bit of an outlier, South Korea and Japan. They're not geographically in the West. But when it comes to policies kind of being in line with particularly American foreign policy, also the fact that democracy as we know it in Japan and South Korea was very much inspired by those US pushes, that is a scary thing for me personally, but then also for the podcast in general.
Yeah, of course. That's exactly it. If this had been a country with a democracy that had only started like in, let's say, 2015, then you would say, oh, the early years are always difficult. But this is a well-established democracy that's very much accepted as a member of the Western democratic global system. It's economically integrated. As you said, it's politically integrated. Foreign policy is integrated. Culture, of course, differs among the West. You know, American culture is different from Spanish culture. Spanish culture is different from Korean culture. Korean culture is different from Japanese culture, obviously. But there are very clear similarities that put them into the same box. And that's what I'm saying. This is not some kind of thing that happens in a individual country with no relevance to the rest of the world or no relevance to Europe or North America. If this had been, let's say, Myanmar, then you could say, okay, that is just very specific to Myanmar. That has very little to do with Spain or Germany or the UK. But this is South Korea. It is very much in the same class and group of countries. And as a result, it would be too dangerous to believe or to walk around thinking that this is just something that could never ever happen here. It could absolutely happen in Europe, and it could absolutely happen in North America or Japan or somewhere else.
It's funny that you bring up Myanmar, because that exactly happened in Myanmar three years ago, right?
Of course, that's why I mentioned it. But that is why in a situation like Myanmar, you wouldn't actually make the connection with the Western bubble, because it's clearly not part of those dynamics. It's not, Myanmar doesn't have that, those democratic liberal credentials that South Korea does have. And it would be a stretch to say, oh, because there's a coup in Myanmar, it could also happen in Switzerland. That doesn't make any sense. But the moment that you see something like this in South Korea, or the moment that you see events happening in North America, then you think, okay, this is actually relevant to the reality of Western Europe as well.
Let's look at the case itself, right, and what exactly happened. So as you already mentioned, the president was somewhat frustrated with his own political situation, right? He very narrowly won the elections a few months ago. And he, since he has been in power, right, the opposition has tried to impeach some of his ministers. He doesn't have a majority in parliament, so governing is very difficult. He has also been very heavily criticized within the media, as happens when you are a president, right? And particularly as happens when you're not doing too well. However, in the West, people were actually kind of happy with him, because he very much steered towards the United States, being very critical of China. he kind of tried to do good with relations with Japan, right? Which is for colonial reasons in the past has been very difficult. So in the West, he was generally perceived as, good South Korean president who is more pro-West and is trying to stay away from China and therefore supporting our foreign policy goals in the Pacific. That can only be good.
And also crucially, being very much on the hawkish side towards North Korea, right? Which is always something that that fits nicely into that Western element of you need to be able to identify the bad guys in the world. So he was very much like, we South Korea are the good guys. We don't want necessarily get close to the North Korean regime. They're the bad guys, just like China are the bad guys. And that is something that Western foreign policy always feels comfortable with, right? We're continuously judging the rest of the world along lines of who is with us and who is against us. And that's what Jun exactly did. He played that game very well at an international level to be close to the West. Of course, intellectually, it is an untenable position to take. You cannot divide the world in good versus evil. That's not how the complexity of humanity, of the human condition works. But from a foreign policy perspective, to ingratiate himself with Washington and European capitals, it worked perfectly.
Well, unfortunately, he also played that game domestically, right? Where he said, I can easily tell you who the bad guys are. That's the opposition. Those are the guys who will not let me govern. And instead of kind of walking towards them and maybe going for a compromise, he then declared martial law on them, right? Very specifically telling the military, hey, you need to, political parties are now illegal. The media also has to stop reporting. All of this is now illegal. There was this very popular example that kind of caught my attention of this YouTuber, of this blogger, who is who basically is very critical of him. And who, within these 6 hours, right, because you can't really shut down a news organization within 6 hours, but basically right off the bat, there were 10 basically security forces outside his house, and he had to go into hiding in his house because he was very, particularly critical of Yoon. And I assume he had some personal private bone to pick with him. Right, so there were these scary moments where then also the military tried to block off parliament, and then there were these images of parliamentarians trying to enter parliament, right? And then, which they ultimately they succeeded in, and then they basically voted to end martial law after 6 hours. And then Yoon kind of stepped out of the press and said, oh, you know what, that didn't work. Okay, I'll take the martial law back. Sorry.
Yeah. And it is, I would hope for South Korean society that he will be politically thrown out of office and that there will be legal procedures against him. That is the only right response within a democratic system, right? Someone tries to basically collapse democracy, then there need to be legal consequences to that. But what is particularly important to realize here that it was a very incompetent, almost spur of the moment way of doing it. It was what I just mentioned before. It wasn't done in any way that would ever work, because the South Korean people at that moment didn't feel that they were under threat from anything. The threat was the declaration of martial law. The South Koreans weren't afraid. They didn't see the military as a means to protect them. And that's what you need in order to overthrow democracy, right? Fear is an incredibly powerful motivator. And if people are fearful because of war, because of terrorism, because of a virus, then that is the moment that democracy is very vulnerable. In this case, there was no such thing, and the only fear existed in Yoon's own head, because he was in trouble politically and legally, and that is just never going to fly. I would just reiterate now and next year and in 10 years' time, that the moment we are fearful of anything is the moment that we have to stand up for democracy as well as we can, right? That within democratic society. That's the moment that you have to say, okay, I am afraid of terrorists. I am afraid of an enemy. I am afraid of all kinds of things. But that doesn't mean that my government should be given unlimited powers. That is when it really matters.
Well, we had a situation like this just a few years ago with COVID, right? And we recorded a very long episode on exactly that matter, on how scary that can be. Yoon tried, I mean, he didn't have a terrorist, but he did have North Korea, right? And he tried to portray the opposition as communists and basically North Korean lackeys trying to undermine South Korea. And I mean, hey, maybe there are some people within South Korean society who then said, oh, you know what, might not be too wrong. One of the other things that made me upset and still is making me upset is, I mean, luckily, right, that night, 190 lawmakers out of the 300 in the South Korean parliament then voted basically to shut martial law down. There were some members of Yoon's own party in there. But then the next day or the next 2 days, right, something that you would basically, you would expect that immediately everyone drops this president and says, okay, sir, this, you just went crazy there for a night. You're no longer fit to be president. We now need to remove you from power. But on Thursday, so just yesterday, basically the ruling party, right? So Yoon's own party, the leader still said that they would block any impeachment processes, because, you know, hey, this is, we need to unite behind our leader to kind of defeat the opposition-led motion to impeach the leader. And only today, I think, I don't know if they received a call maybe from the White House or if they actually looked into the things a little bit more, the leader kind of came out and said, oh, you know what, more evidence, very credible evidence has actually come up saying that he really wanted to arrest politicians and basically throw them into jail. And okay, that's problematic, right? Now we're actually going to impeach him because, you know, this new evidence has come up. And here my question is, sir, how deep inside your own tribe are you that's not your first reaction, that your first reaction immediately is storming to the parliament saying, I am from the ruling party, you cannot do this, stand down, soldiers, and then having 300 lawmakers in the parliament saying this and immediately impeaching the man.
I was just about to say, it's a very good example of tribalism, that if it is your tribe, you stand by them. This is one of my frustrations, which is not as important as declaring martial law, but it's still very relevant. One of my frustrations when it comes to corruption, right? If there's corruption in the Democratic Party, Democrats will try to support their leader. If there's corruption in the Republican Party, they will jump at it like vultures trying to tear the Republican Party apart. The same you can see in a country like Spain, where I live, where if PSOE has corruption, then the PSOE politicians will try to defend it. And if PP has corruption, the PSOE politicians will try to, you know, milk it to the largest extent possible. It is political tribalism at its worst. And it is not what a well-functioning political system should be like. Regardless of whether this person is from your party or from the other party, you have to treat them with the same standards. Now, we understand psychologically why this is not the case, right? So if you see your friends, a friend that you've known forever, you see your friends, I don't know, pushing an old lady in the street, you will think, oh, there must be a really good reason, because this is my friend. I know he's a good person. He wouldn't just push an old lady in the streets. There must be something that is causing this. And you will try to find excuses for him. If you see a stranger pushing an old lady, then you will be outraged. How dare this stranger push this old lady? That is how our human psychology works. Those who are close to us get the benefit of the doubt. Those that are not part of our circle, and especially those that are part of our rival circle, we'll get the brunt of our vengeance. And this is one of the really core weaknesses of democratic politics, where you just cannot rely on politicians to make the right choices with respect to their own circle. And it's also one of the reasons why political elites and economic elites are so blind to the realities of the world around them. They know themselves, they know each other, and they don't really know anyone outside of their bubble, so they will always stand up for their own bubble.
Yeah, that's it's concerning. It's really, I don't know, because again, this seems like such a clear-cut example of, okay, we can all agree that this is bad. you know, and we can all vote this person out. But yeah, the fact that this takes a few days and there's still political considerations and so on and so forth, it really sickens me, and this happens all the time.
Yeah, and you see acts happen that according to any of your usual criteria would be reprehensible, would be repulsive, would be wrong, would be criminal. But because these acts are committed by people that you trust or that are part of your self-image, that are part of your in-crowd, of your own bubble, you do not apply those same criteria to them. And this happens throughout society. This happens throughout human history. This is part of who we are as human beings, but that doesn't make it any less destructive, right? There are certain lines that when they are crossed, we need to react very clearly against that, whether it is your own brother or whether it is your political enemy. It doesn't matter. The same criteria have to be applied equally. Otherwise, society cannot function.
And this example, right, in South Korea also shows how important it is to strengthen your political institutions. Oh, no, not the political, just your institutions. Because, right, in case... So South Korean politics is a bit more complicated. Well, at least to me, it appears very complicated because, right, I don't live there now and I don't engage with it on a daily basis. But basically, this impeachment of Yoon could also go to the Supreme Court in South Korea, which is a real problem because there are currently three vacant positions. Right, so there's nine positions overall, and there's only six of them filled because basically South Korean politics have not been able to agree on who would basically fill these vacancies, and that's a real problem if you have a president, right, who's putting forward these proposals. They are not being agreed upon. Therefore, the Supreme Court cannot really function that well. And then you have a political crisis like this, where, your leader is basically is trying to declare martial law to take out the opposition of the country, right? And this was one of the statements of the ruling party's leader, right? Who said that the things that has changed for me now is that I'm worried that Yoon doesn't feel like he did anything wrong and he might do this again. Right, it's a really scary situation that South Korean society, politics, and institutions are currently in. And as you said just a few minutes ago, right, is that this is something that we could be facing in other countries in the West too.
Well, and what you just mentioned about the Supreme Court, this is exactly what you see elsewhere. I mean, in the United States, the seats are filled, but they are filled basically purely on political grounds. They're not filled built on competence, right? So in an idea, if you were to design a well-functioning society, you would say politicians are politicians. Maybe even it's inevitable that they're part of parties that creates tribalism, but it is almost inevitable that that happens, all right? But Supreme Court justices, or any kind of judge for that matter, should be non-political. It should not depend on their political views. It should depend on their legal competence, on how good they are in applying the law. And if that were the criteria, then it shouldn't be at all hard to fill the seats in a Supreme Court, right? Because there are plenty of competent judges around in Korea or elsewhere. But nowadays, that's no longer the basis on which we try to get them. We try to get them in if we believe that they adhere to our political ideology, our hopes and dreams about the future. If in the United States, if you're a Democrat, you want someone who will restore Roe v. Wade. If you are a Republican, you want someone who will support incoming President Trump. This is, again, one of those signs of corruption of democratic liberalism, a sign of the good governance system that we build up over hundreds of years sliding away from us. And it is deeply, deeply concerning. And anyone that listens to me saying this, who actually thinks, yeah, that makes sense, Balder, you're absolutely right, also should think, yeah, but are you then okay with, if you are in that position, not making it political? Because that's the problem, right? So theoretically, people will agree with me. But once they are in a position of actually electing those Supreme Court justices, they make it political nonetheless. They forego their own principles, those theoretical principles about what good governance looks like, in order to win the political fight. And that's where it goes horribly wrong.
Very much. Another symptom kind of showing that decay, right, within the West in general right now, is the next case that we want to talk about. And we usually when we talk about people dying on this podcast, there's a number of people dying, right? We're talking about real tragedies, and usually we're talking about war-related scenarios. But today we're talking about the murder of one person, and that's Brian Thompson, who was the CEO of United Healthcare in the United States. And he was basically shot in broad daylight in New York. Balder, why are we talking about this? I mean, this tragedy, right? This poor man being killed out on the open street.
Yeah, so I think I'm correct. I didn't look this up, but I believe that there are at least a year, something like 10,000 people being shot dead in the United States. A gun-centric society where this happens much more easily than in most other countries. Just one person dying is always, of course, a moment of sadness for the family, for the friends, but it shouldn't actually receive much interest. And I would also argue that in this case, we're talking about a relatively rich person who had a relatively comfortable lifestyle. In fact, a very rich person with a very comfortable lifestyle. In many ways, I think that has less emotional resonance to us than, let's say, a child dying because of starvation, right? Or a child dying because of abuse. So of all the people to care about dying, that die on a daily basis, some of whom are murdered, this doesn't seem to be a likely case. However, what makes this interesting is that this was the CEO of one of the largest health insurers in the United States, and it seems that his assassination, his murder, was directly linked to him being the CEO. It wasn't some kind of crime, a robbery gone wrong or mugging gone wrong. It was a clearly, carefully planned assassination, specifically of the CEO of this health insurer. And that is already interesting, because this is something that we've been warning about for as long as this podcast exists. And before us, many, many way more intelligent people have already laid the foundation for this as well. The idea that if you are a political or economic elite, you are making your own existence and your own future more vulnerable, less scarier by no longer being in touch with the reality of the society around you, right? By continuously pushing for less taxation, trying to become even wealthier, expanding your opulence, not giving back to society, not understanding that people are dying in the street. You are essentially, if you're part of the elite and you're Jeff Bezos or you're Carlos Slim or you're any of those people who are driving around in these incredibly expensive cars, flying in their private airplanes, enjoying life on their yachts, then what you're doing is you're making your own future and your children's future less likely to be successful, because you are stimulating revolution. You're stimulating a uprising of those people who are suffering in the same system where you are benefiting to such a large extent. Now, that is exactly the case of what happened here, right? So if it is true, and we still haven't found the murderer, but if it is true that this man was murdered not because of his personality or his something that happened in a familiar environment or something like that, but he was murdered because he was the CEO of this health insurer, then this is a sign of society actually having had enough. People actually moving towards violence against the elites. And that is very concerning, not just for the elites, but for the whole society, because some people have reacted with, oh, this is great, this is finally he gets what he deserves, or those elites get what they deserve. But revolution is typically not a path towards prosperity for anyone, right?
Well, you just said, right, that this person being shot is a sign that society is fed up. I think that's a sign of this individual who shot him being very fed up. But then exactly the reaction to this, I think, is a sign of society being fed up, right? Because I remember like murders like these happening in Germany in the, well, I don't remember them. I've learned about them, right? In the 80s, where we had like left-wing terrorism, right? Where like, for example, the CEO of a big bank, right? He was kind of, he was kidnapped, right? And they tried to put a lot of attention on the problems of the system. But the reaction back then was mostly about this poor man being kidnapped. What are these crazy people doing? But the reaction now, today, is, right, here, let me just quote this article from The Guardian, right, where the headline reads, Brian Thompson's killing sparks outrage over state of U.S. healthcare, right? Not over the poor man being killed, but over state of U.S. healthcare. And then the article continues that Americans turn to social media to discuss dire experiences at hands of health insurance companies. That's exactly what you were saying, right, is where... Now, the main topic is not this man being killed, but kind of like, oh, you know what? My healthcare provider is really bad. This man probably deserved it. And we need to, well, that's the thing, right? I don't know where these conversations go, whether we need to change things or whether we need to actually start a revolution of sorts.
Yeah, and the issue here is not just that the healthcare system in the United States is broken. It clearly is. It's not functioning. And this has been covered over and over again over the past decades. The issue here is that a small group of people are actually benefiting from the system while large groups of people suffer because of the system. And that is not sustainable. That is not a way to build a long-term prosperous society. So this specific CEO, I believe he had an annual salary of about $10 million. Dollars, which is problematic if you make choices that deprive people of basic medication that could save lives, right? We know that every year tens of thousands of people, I saw the statistic 30 to 40,000, I don't know if that's correct, but at least tens of thousands of people in the United States die unnecessarily because they couldn't afford health care, because they didn't have the right insurance or anything like that. And if you, as a CEO of a company like that, make $10 million a year in a system where people are dying because of your own choices, then that is deeply, deeply disturbing and ugly. So the problem is not just that the system isn't working, it's that it is working for some people, and those people are willfully ignorant or just willfully continue their own luxurious position on the expense of others. And that is a sign of really, really corrupt and unsustainable dynamics. That is the problem. If he had been the CEO of a broken system, but he had said, I know that I've got a very important job to do because I don't really have the solutions for American healthcare. It's difficult. There's politics involved. There are all kinds of things. But I want to do the best thing possible. And as a result, I'm going to cap my salary to, let's say, $500,000. You know, that's a really good income.
That pushes him at the poverty line, Walder. You can't do that to the poor man.
You know, but so this is exactly the issue, right? So if they were to say, I know that this isn't great, and I know we've got serious problems, and unfortunately, sometimes people do not get the healthcare that they deserve, and I'm working every day to change this. But I also understand that I shouldn't be earning $10 million a year. I should only be earning like $500,000 a year. Otherwise, this is morally not sustainable, then it would have been a different story. But this is an elite that act as if they are entitled to all their wealth, as if their wealth is not given to them by society, as if they are somehow the ones who create the wealth for themselves, while all those thousands and millions of, if you like, poor Americans are suffering because of that system. And yeah, then you get this. Then you get a situation like this. That's, first of all, people start acting violently. This is one act of violence, but I wouldn't be surprised if more are to follow in the future. And I'm not saying that with any glee or happiness. Violence and murder is always horrific. You're killing another human being. Please don't. But that is one thing. But the other thing is that it's clear from the whole reaction of media and social media that essentially the world is getting fed up. And this is bad news because it will lead to rebellion. It will lead to revolution. And there are no winners from that, typically.
Not at all. No. It's... Yeah. Let's have a little bit of a fact check moment. Just because I quickly Googled that that study you said, and yeah, it's exactly as you say, right? About 45,000 Americans die each year, however, who are of working age, right? So I think the number might be a lot higher because this study, for some reason, only included Americans from 18 to 64. But at the same time, Baldi, you did underestimate a number earlier about the number of gun-related deaths in the U.S., right, of murderers, which is a lot higher. It's also somewhere, like, it varies, right, but it's always also somewhere between 45 and 50,000 people. And that's just for the listeners who were already sending us angry emails that we misrepresented a number here. I hope you didn't send them before you stopped listening to the episode or finished listening to the episode.
I'm at least happy that I underestimated it, because that it only reinforces the point we were making.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, so this is, yeah, this, I mean, I get this feeling a lot more on social media nowadays, that people are unhappy with how the system is and with some of the aspects of the system, for an example, labor unions, kind of being treated badly by the system, right? So there is, I mean, there are big companies in the United States that are always trying to kind of discourage their workers from forming unions, right? So Starbucks, Amazon, they are kind of notoriously known for this. And then the other day is kind of another article stating exactly that. I saw this meme as a reaction, kind of saying that, do the billionaires realize that 150 years ago, the way we handled this business of wanting higher wages would basically result in the workers kicking down the doors of the factory owner and then beating him until they got their higher salary or else? And that unions are the civilized way we came up with of dealing with these issues. And I think that's exactly, and well, that's the point, right? That elites are no longer understanding what is required for them to remain elites, because in a revolution, nobody wins, but the elites certainly don't.
No, that's exactly the issue. Unions and paying taxes, paying high taxes, higher if you have a higher income, progressively higher, I mean, not just in terms of absolute numbers, because sometimes there are people saying, do you know how many taxes Jeff Bezos, how many millions or billions in taxes Bezos or Elon Musk pay every year? Yeah, but as a percentage of their income, it's really not that impressive. It's only impressive in absolute terms. Progressively, paying higher taxes, having trade unions, having limits to your political power are there for you to maintain your wealth. If you take those things away, if you don't pay your taxes, if you don't have trade unions, and you don't have limits on your political power, you are endangering your own and your children's and your grandchildren's opulent lifestyle. Because at some point society breaks, and at some point society is going to say, we don't recognize ourselves anymore in this. Why is there this guy flying around in private airplanes, private yachts and those kinds of things, while my children can barely be fed every week because I can't afford to buy them food? It is just not sustainable, and it's so short-sighted. It is so idiotic for those economic elites to go down this path and to all the time fight for more benefits, for less regulation, fewer limits to their power, fewer limits to their abundance. I wonder who their advisors are, whether they actually stop and think for a second about this or not, or whether they actually tell themselves a story that everything is fine and that society should be grateful for their presence and that they are God's gift to humanity, which might be the case. Maybe that's the bubble that they live in. I don't know.
It probably is. And now let's dive into our last topic, into the collapse of the French government, right? I mean, it sounds so dramatic when I say it that way, but in France this happens more often than in other countries, right? This is the reason why a few weeks ago I was so shocked when the German government collapsed, because that doesn't happen that often here. But this is another sign, right, of this happening more, I would say more frequent in Europe, of governments kind of collapsing in that sense. Because it does seem like that the establishment, right now, the political establishment, not the elites, economic elites that we were talking about before, it seems like they're no longer really fit to serve their purpose, or at least they're no longer able to do so within the system that we've designed.
Yeah, so this is a case of the middle, the political middle, no longer being able to relate to voters, no longer having the support of society, trying to manage society as it is, right? So very much in line with this idea of the billionaire elites just trying to continue the path that they're on. You've got political elites trying to stay in the middle and not take difficult decisions. And as a result, they're being torn apart from the right and the left, especially from the populists on both sides, right? Saying it's no longer working. You cannot pretend that you don't need to have some big ideas about how to change this dynamic. In that sense, the French political middle is no different from the Dutch political middle. Germany is slightly different in that sense still, but it's also going in that direction. Spanish political middle, it is essentially a sign of the times, right? Where the political middle are a bunch of managers who are unwilling or unable to actually take a position towards the future. They're basically trying to hold on to the past rather than creating a new future that people can get behind. And as a result, the parties that win are those that are shouting about exactly political revolution, major changes, standing up for the people, etc. And France is a very good example of that.
Speaking of political managers, how long do you think Keir Starmer, the current Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, will be around? Because he does seem like one of those middle management guys as well.
He is the perfect example of middle management. Without a clear vision, a lot of, you know, well-prepared speeches, but that are hollow on the inside. He will be around for quite a while because he's got this enormous majority in the British Parliament. Well, unlike the French system has this weird relationship between president and government, right? Where the government can fall, but Macron as president can stay in. In the UK, there's no other head of state. Well, there's the king, but the king has no political power. So Starmer has enough of a Labour majority to stay in power for quite a while, unless some kind of civil war within the Labour Party breaks out. But to be honest, he's done a good job at sort of cleansing his own party of the most left-wing elements, and it's unlikely that that will happen. So he'll be around for a while. But you're absolutely right that he is one of those. He's one of those people who try to build a case that the only thing that is needed is common decency and managerial competence. All we need is people who take that middle ground, that aren't too extreme, that aren't too radical, and as a result, do not offend anyone. Well, that is not enough in the 21st century, especially in a world with social media, especially in a world where you've got this increasing divide in society between the multimillionaires and billionaires on the one hand and increasing poverty on the other hand, which is especially notable in Britain, by the way. And it's just not enough to say we will be decent, competent politicians. You need to have a story. You need to have a vision of where you want to take the country. And it's very clear that Starmer and current Labour don't have such a vision. And as a result, I'm worried about the next election. Not that that election will come soon. He still has 4 years. But it might be very ugly because people will be further disenfranchised and start voting for the popular right, especially in the United Kingdom.
Well, this seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on South Korea. A person, right, a healthcare CEO being killed and nobody talking about it, but the other thing. The collapse of the French government and the managerial attitudes of the UK government. If you have heard any, like, if you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, except the one on the gun-related deaths, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com. And we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western Bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Well, before I tell you which quote I've chosen, I'm wondering if it's relevant to tell our listeners that we are not political because You know, those who have listened to many episodes will hopefully give us the benefit of the doubt. But I do realize that this conversation that we've just been having is very much kind of a left-leaning kind of position, right? And even though if you were to ask me, Badr, what are the two biggest problems in the world, the first would be income inequality for me, and the second one would be the environment. Not in that order necessarily, but those two are the main, you know, probably the environment goes before income inequality, because without a planet, we're all dead. But that would indicate some kind of left-wing political leaning. I think it's also absolutely fair to say that I don't have a political identity in that sense, and neither do you. That's clearly defined. I would never call myself left-wing or right-wing. I would never be part of a political party, anything like that. So this analysis of needing to do something is more me reacting to a world that has very aggressively shifted to the right, if you like, in terms of taxation, in terms of the system, and trying to restore some sanity rather than being some kind of socialist revolutionary, right? I just want to get that out of the way, because the quote I've chosen is from good old Bernie Sanders, who I know for American listeners sometimes is seen as some kind of wild Marxist. For European listeners, he's maybe slightly left of center, if that. But of course, he is known for this kind of fight against wealth accumulation, against social injustices and all that. And he wrote, "You can't have it all. You can't get huge tax breaks while children in this country go hungry. You can't continue sending our jobs to China while millions are looking for work. You can't hide your profits in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens while there are massive unmet needs on every corner of this nation. Your greed has got to end. You cannot take advantage of all the benefits of America if you refuse to accept your responsibilities."